SF material, which is actually them writing from their own perspective, and it only has some Seth books at the end, some of the readings at the end. And then Seth Speaks is the original Seth book that was written totally by this this intelligence. Those books are quite intriguing and fascinating. So I was aware of those books and a couple other things that in the fullness of time didn't end up panning out as well. I also had read another source that I was highly intrigued by called The Law of One, which again apparently was derived from channeling. It was material that came through from 1981 and 1983, in which there's a dialogue taking place the whole time between a PhD physicist named Dr. Don Elkins and this allegedly disembodied intelligence that was claiming to be two huge levels of evolution, actually three evolutionary leaps ahead of where we are now. We are in what they would call third density or third dimension, and they are in what they call sixth density or sixth dimension. So I had a robust background of the Law of One, the Seth books, and to some degree the Casey readings. And I'd read the Law of One beginning in January of 1996, and it wasn't until November of 96 that I started doing this dream voice stuff. And originally it seemed very private. I didn't ever think anybody would know about this besides myself. I never would have even done it if I had thought that it was going to go public. And that continued for an entire year, where I built up this relationship with this source of intelligence. And as I was saying to you, here's the most important point, is that I was dictating this into tapes, but then I would get backlogged on my transcriptions. And the typical length of the backlog was 2 weeks to a month.
Who was doing the transcribing?
I was.
Okay.
But I also was working during the day at a job in dealing with day treatment for people with developmental disabilities. And because I was the guy with the bachelor's in psychology, they threw me in the behavior room, where they segregated all the people that had the most extreme behaviors. And this included things like hair mouthing, where they'd try to take your hair and put it in their mouth. This included pica, where they would eat things that were not edible, like dirt.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can extrapolate from there. It was a very difficult job.
Minimum wage.
Minimum wage. I made $5.77 an hour.
Right.
And so the only time I had to do any of this other stuff was when I got home at night. And sometimes the sound of the screaming was, it would take about an hour for the screaming to get out of my head when I come home. I'd literally get home, get in bed in the dark, and just stare at the ceiling until the screaming stopped in my mind. And then I would get up and I would, you know, go online. I'd listen to Art Bell.
Right.
I'd, you know, transcribe my tapes.
Yeah, clear your mind with a little art. A lot of good that did. Jeez.
Oh, so man. What would happen is that these tapes would stack up on my desk. Sometimes there'd be even a stack of like four that hadn't been transcribed. And then I would start transcribing, and it wasn't just once in a while. It was every single time I started to transcribe these tapes, no matter how old the work was that I had done, it would invariably start describing something that I had just seen or heard right before I sat down. And so there's a variety of strange examples. I had gone to see, for example, I think it was the episode one, the new Star Wars film had come out. And I had just seen the film, and I came home and did some transcribing, and it referenced something that was in the film that I couldn't have known back when I did the dictation. Another example that I've shared before, but it was so amazing, so poignant, was that I had gone to a local convenience store, and there was a little girl with this orange round plastic toy that she had on her belt. It was called a Tamagotchi. It's like this little digital chicken that you're supposed to feed, and if you don't feed it, it dies.
I still have like 20 of those here at the house. I'm not kidding. With a little battery in it. Right. And those things would die, and my daughters would just lose their minds. That was a 2-3 year period.
Well, I saw a little girl playing with this Tamagotchi, and then I went back to my desk and started to transcribe, and the very next scene was from one of my dreams, where a little girl's got this orange round toy.
Right.
Probably the single most mind-blowing example of which, there was probably at least 30 or 40 that were incredible, but probably the most incredible one was that I had a girlfriend who would go to the ARE. I didn't want to go there once this whole Edgar Cayce thing started to happen, which we'll discuss, but she had just gone to the ARE. She saw some guy who was only there for one day, an old friend of hers, and she asked me to stop transcribing so she could tell me a story. So I stopped the tape, and she told me that this guy had showed her pictures of a building where the top floor of the building was made to look like a UFO flying saucer with little round porthole windows on top. I said, yeah, that's cool. It'd be great to see something like that. You know, it'd be fun to go up there. Next thing I know, I go back to my tape, and I hit play. And the very next thing on the tape is my voice in a dream describing seeing a building where the top floor is fashioned to look like a UFO.
No.
Literally all the hair on my arm stood up on end.
Right.
I immediately hit stop. I rewound it. I said, come over here right now, and played it for her. And we both were just absolutely mind blown. I started to do this for clients only after maybe, I don't know, 3 years of perfecting the technique. One of the first clients I had lived in Knoxville, Tennessee, and he was very excited to get his cassette because I would mail people the cassette, and so he had been waiting. He was running out to the mailbox every day to check. He'd woken up with a dream where he was having trouble setting up a tripod for a camera, and one of the three legs of the tripod kept collapsing. And he goes and listens to the tape, and then in the tape, my dream that I revealed at the beginning, because I'd always have a dream for the client first that would remarkably touch on their issues every time, and I did 500 of these. In the dream, there's a tripod that wouldn't stand up straight, and one of the legs kept collapsing. And then when the reading began, and this voice that's essentially speaking as my voice, but it's some greater part of myself, and I just let it happen, I'm dimly aware of what it's saying, but I try not to track anything. I try to just let it happen. The first thing it says is the tripod represents, and then proceed to explain that he wasn't supporting himself enough, and that's what it was meant to indicate. So he was blown away and greatly regretted that he hadn't told his wife his dream before he went out and grabbed the tape in the mailbox. So I had an astonishing amount of undeniable validation that something was happening that was far more significant than just a self-delusion. And this intelligence had the ability to look at time just like it was fast-forwarding and rewinding a tape and see the most likely outcomes that would occur and reveal them in tapes and calibrate it so well that for over a year, this happened for probably the first 2 or 3 years, almost every time I sat down and started transcribing, it would describe something that I'd just seen or heard or done. Another example I'm just remembering now is I was in Woodstock, because I lived in Rosendale, which is right near Woodstock, New York, where the famous festival was.
Been there.
And I was in some kind of Jewish deli, and I'd had a sandwich, and there was a guy there who was big, you know, a lot of people in Woodstock are, of course, hippies, meditators, new agey types.
They never left. They were there in 69 at 18, and they never left. Yeah.
Having this whole conversation. He got all into Joseph Campbell, which I love Joseph Campbell's work, and he knew more about it than I did. And he gave me this whole big thing, this whole big dissertation on the idea that we're all really looking at the same thing when we see different religions. We think the religions are different, but they're really not. And Campbell's line was that it's just different forms of software of accessing the same hardware, which is this universal mind. And so I was really blown away by that. I said, wow, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's just different operating systems that we're using. I come home from this trip. I sit down, I say, now feels like a good time to transcribe. And the very first thing is my voice speaking on behalf of these higher forces saying, we are downloading and installing new software. The first thing it said. I mean, that's another one where all the hair on my arm stood up.
What do you do? What do you do when you have the email and the YouTube videos that are going, you know, Wilcox or fraud?
You know, there's some horrible, horrible hate out there. If people want to hate me, they can find all kinds of things they'll love to see.
And how do you deal with it? And do you ever address it directly?
Well, you know, everybody wants proof. Everybody wants validation. Part of the validation is I've had 500 clients. Any one of them, well, probably not all of them, but I would say probably at least 20 to 30% of them, if it ever came down to that, would probably be willing to catch my back and confirm what would happen, which is that I would dream a dream for them that would so remarkably give details about their personal lives that they would burst into tears. In fact, people crying on the phone was so common that I had to learn to not empathize with the crying because it would interfere with my ability to do the job.
Right.
So I'd talk to people for like back in those days, it was all 90-minute cassette tapes. As you probably remember, 120-minute, you have the risk of it breaking and being eaten by the machine.
Warbling.
Yeah, so 90 minutes is about the longest cassette you could use. So what I would do is I'd talk to people for 45 minutes on the first side and just kind of get to know them and tell them the dream that I had that morning, which was invariably about them. And then the second 45 minutes, I would do this reading. And so I have every single cassette of every single reading I've ever done. I still have all of them. A lot of those were private, so I couldn't just start disclosing everybody's readings, but there's tons and tons and tons of recordings of people just bawling when I tell them these dreams.
Is that like a burden? How do you feel about that? And do you have to hold back sometimes where you just know somebody doesn't need to hear this? And they could be also, you have the obligation of maybe dealing with somebody that might not be mentally stable.
I had a few difficult clients. I would say that the only cases of genuine client dissatisfaction, there was one or two cases where I did a reading for somebody when I really shouldn't have, when I had low energy, I was weak and tired, and I let them push me into it. One was on a trip in Egypt, and another one was at the tail end of a conference that I did in San Francisco. And in those two specific cases, it was still a reading, but it was fairly generic, and those people didn't feel like it had enough connection to their personal lives that they enjoyed it. So there was a couple fails like that out of 500, and then there were maybe about four clients out of 500 where they got very, very angry about their reading.
Mm-hmm.
And in one case, this woman literally stormed out of my apartment and didn't want to be. She demanded that I, you know, give her money back because she'd paid me at the beginning, and I did.
Okay.
I said, no problem. You know, if you don't like it, I'm not going to try to take your money. And then about 10, 11 minutes later, I hear this knock on the door, and she comes back in the house, and she says, I couldn't start my car. That's the first thing she said. And I'm just kind of like standing there trying not to laugh, like, okay,
right.
Couldn't start your car. Why couldn't you start your car? She's like, well, I couldn't see the ignition. Okay, why couldn't you see the ignition? Then she starts crying. She says, because there were so many tears in my eyes. I'm like, oh, my
okay,
God.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, well, I think you misunderstood the question, actually.
Okay.
I appreciate your candor. But, what I'm saying is, do you ever find yourself holding back because you know you're dealing with somebody that probably couldn't handle the information?
Oh, yeah. No, I called that absolutely. I called it the rule of 10%.
And
you
what
never
about
give people more than 10% of what you could tell them because it's gonna break the circuitry.
That's what I'm saying. And do you,
yeah.
How do you recognize somebody that could be, you know, mentally unstable or not prepared for what you're about? And you know, because you have a moral obligation, you don't need to push somebody over the edge.
Yeah, part of why I had to stop doing this, part of why I retired, even though you know, I was making a living from it just barely. I mean, I could only do 12 a month. You know, I could do 3 out of 4 weeks a month every other day. So I could do like 12 a month. And I only charge $150 a client. So it was just barely enough money to get by. But what happened was that people couldn't handle more than a certain amount of truth. And I would burn out if I did too much. So I would talk to people, and towards the end, what happened was that I started to get more and more public and more well-known, and people's expectations started to go up. And the ultimate reason why I retired in 2005 was that people started to expect too much. People started to have me on a pedestal. They started to think they were going to get more than they could get. So here's a very interesting phenomenon. The reading was not of any better quality than the quality of the soul's path of the person that was coming to me for the reading. So if somebody wasn't really trying very hard, like, for example, if I had a guy who was a severe alcoholic and beat his wife, which I did have,
right,
then basically he's going to be told, stop drinking and deal with your anger. But I had a lady who was a very advanced spiritual seeker who, unbeknownst to me before the reading started, she was writing all these poems and songs, and the reading was actually quoting her poems and telling her, you know, like, I had no idea she even wrote these poems. The reading actually quoted from the poems and then not only told her the words, but actually explained why she had written these poems and what they meant and what her soul was trying to tell her by having her write those lyrics. So it was very bizarre because I could not guarantee quality.
Right, right, right.
I could only guarantee that there would be a reading and that something would happen. Everybody got something they enjoyed, but some people did complain that it was generic, whereas other people got dazzlingly proficient psychic time-bending stuff that couldn't have possibly come out unless there was some sort of omniscient intelligence speaking.
Okay, I've got a bunch of email in front of me, and so I'm going to bang through these.
Okay.
Since they got in here to me, that they are relevant,
okay,
so they should be good. But I'm just going to open them up and go. You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, first question, and this is from Renee in Tucson. What is the scientific cause of the current rising vibration rates on and around Earth? See, we've got good listeners, man.
Okay.
Digest that one.
Sure. The actual answer is a little bit complicated, but I can give you the answer. The answer is that there is a companion star to our own star that the Freemasons are all over. It's what the all-seeing eye represents. They also call it the Black Sun. There's the Order of the Black Sun that the Nazis were all about. It's in many cultures, including the Aztecs. They all talk about the Black Sun. Unbeknownst to most people, there is this large gravitating body. The Sumerians called it Nibiru, and we are orbiting this body. But Zechariah Sitchin thought it was a 3,600-year orbit. That's actually incorrect. It's a 25,000-year orbit. At the end of that orbit, there is a geometric energy field that is created by the resonance of that star, and that would be a long discussion that I'd gladly have, but I don't know how much we could go into it here.
Right.
But when you come into that energy field, there is a very noticeable change in the basic frequencies of matter and energy. The first full-length show I had with Art was with Richard Hoagland, in which I was unveiling the work that I'd done. This was back in, I think, 2004, where I took NASA studies and showed that every planet in our solar system is experiencing remarkable climate change. The sun is at the highest level of solar energy output in the last 8,000 years right now. Mercury has grown a magnetic field in just the last 20 years. Venus is having a huge increase in the green glow on the night side, huge increase in the amount of ozone in its atmosphere. Mars is having the growth of clouds and ozone, and what NASA calls global warming is taking place. The ice caps are melting. Jupiter is having a tremendous global warming. Saturn is having huge X-ray bursts coming out. There's also remarkable increases in the brightness and temperature of the aurora at the north and south pole of Saturn. Uranus is having a tremendous increase in the number of bright spots across its surface. Neptune has had a 40% brightness increase in the level just above the visible light spectrum called near-infrared. Pluto, actually, even though it's moving away from the sun, has had a 300% increase in its atmospheric pressure. And then on Earth, just since 1973, we've had over a 400% increase in all earthquakes above 2.5 on the Richter scale. Since 1875, there's been a 500% increase in volcanic activity. There's a new belt that showed up in the Van Allen radiation belts around the Earth's outer atmosphere that they actually call New Belt in NASA, which they say they've never even seen inside the sun and planets before. It's only usually between stars. And we also now are seeing a huge growth in these so-called noctilucent clouds, which are these bright clouds outside the Earth's atmosphere. So the whole solar system is having a very remarkable, measurable, discontinuous change in the activity of the planets. And then you can actually trace this in the human genetic record. The most phenomenal study that showed up after all these years is from Dr. John Hawks, who is an anthropologist who works for University of Wisconsin. And he DNA tested all these mummies and found that in the last 40,000 years, human evolution has remarkably increased, and specifically, in the last 5,000 years, the human genome, the actual structure of the DNA, if you DNA test it in a computer, has changed by 7%, which is unprecedented. And so he says that we are in the midst of this very rapid evolutionary change, which is very difficult to understand. There's also a survey that was done of 1,500 skulls from America dating from the mid-1800s up to 1980 or thereabouts, in which they found that the average American's brain size has increased by the mass of a tennis ball, meaning that if you pushed a tennis ball into the brain, it would increase the mass by that much. So my point in saying this is there is a measurable interplanetary climate change effect, and there is a corresponding genetic change that's actually happening that's measurable in our DNA and in our overall level of intelligence, evolution, etc.
What part of the 25,900 year cycle are we in?
We just ended the whole cycle on December 21st, 2012. The Mayan calendar is 5,125 years long, and that actually is exactly one-fifth of the cycle, precisely measured. And in my first book, The Source Field Investigations, I have all the scientific data. There's over 1,000 academic references in that book. And the scientific data shows that if you look at the basic counting units of the Mayan calendar, they're all calibrated to the orbits of the planets. The basic counting unit that they use throughout Mesoamerica is called the Tzolk'in, which is 260 days. And that's it's a junction of the cycle 20 and the cycle 12.
Right.
It's 12 units of 20. And that basic counting cycle of 260 days is the root common denominator of all the orbits of the inner planets, meaning the orbits of the inner planets are all perfect multiples of 260 days in length, down to the decimal point.
Okay, we're going to bang through some more questions. Here we go. Since aliens are watching over us, what is with diseases, disasters, and global warming?
Okay, this gets into a very interesting conundrum, which is the whole Jesus as the comforter phenomenon that happens in religion, in which people feel like, if there is a God, then why did this bad thing happen? If God existed, then he's supposed to take care of me, and he's supposed to wrap me up and keep me warm so I can suck my thumb and eat candy and not get fat.
Okay. Yes.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, it doesn't.
The universe is meant to teach you through experience. And if you go and hurt people, you don't get a free pass. The problem is that on this planet there's a lot of bad stuff that we've done to each other. And on a greater level, what we need to see is that we don't just go to heaven after one life just because we say that we were saved by the blood of Christ, or whatever other religion tells you that if you follow this way that everything's good. Jesus himself taught reincarnation. Casey was very big on trying to restore that teaching. And Jesus told this to Apostle Peter, who then shared it with St. Clement of Alexandria, who then shared it with Origen. And Origen's writings are the seed of the New Testament and modern Christianity. That was what inspired the New Testament to be put together in the first place. So those, according to Origen, the big secret of Jesus was reincarnation. So when Jesus says, you know, the new heaven and new earth, or the kingdom of the Father, he's not talking about something that you automatically get to just because you decide that you're saved. You have to earn it. It doesn't just happen. And the way you earn it is by balancing your karma, which of course is in the biblical parable, as you sow, so shall you reap. And the Hindus and the Buddhists would call it the law of karma, which basically just means cause and effect.
Well, what about the global warming aspect? Couldn't we expect some ET intervention there? If you know what I mean. I mean, that's something
okay,
that is
yes.
kind of a...
There, and you have to realize, too, this gets into a very subtle inquiry. It's something that's kind of hard to do in a machine gun speed question and answer session, but...
I'm sorry, but I've got more coming, too. So
the idea is that... The universe ultimately, this is what it says in all the best intuitive sources as well as all the ancient spiritual traditions, the universe is alive. So we have to redefine life as that we live in a biological universe. We live in a universe that makes biological life. Consciousness is one of the basic building blocks of the universe. I have a wealth of scientific data I could go on for hours about showing that DNA coalesces out of the basic laws of quantum mechanics itself.
Right.
That the quantum field is built to make life, and that's why there's humans all over the place, because there is an intelligent template that intends for us to be in the bodies that we're in now and ultimately to graduate to higher grades of evolution, where we become much more capable of doing these miracles like you see with Buddha and Krishna and Jesus. So that's all part of apparently what we're supposed to go through. Now, the thing is, it's not like some cosmic light switch gets flipped off at the end of this 25,000-year cycle and we all burst into light body.
Right.
You have to actually choose on your own to go through that. The predominant way that the universe uses to get us evolved is called initiation. And what initiation ultimately means, if you understand it deeply enough, is the mirror principle, which is that whatever we do is going to be mirrored back to us. It's karma. It's cause and effect. So there is no such thing as a private thought or a private action. If you abuse someone, that will come back to you. If you have a negative thought, it's known to everyone in the cosmos. And that means that there's a lot of hidden evil that's been taking place, or negativity, behind closed doors, like, you know, abuse happening in families or abuse happening in the workplace, etc. And so what we're seeing on a global level is a mirroring of that with corrupt governments and, in some cases, Satanism taking place in these inner circles of, you know, Illuminati or whatever you want to call it. And we're also seeing, so that's one level which is becoming increasingly glaring, like the NSA surveillance. That's initiation. That's getting us to look at that there's some really ugly stuff out there, and what it does is it inspires us to change within ourselves so that we don't act that way. But then also there's physical initiation, in which the planet itself is very definitely, from a physical perspective, is definitely in crisis. There's we can look at our society objectively and say we are suicidal. And these governments are standing in the way of us being able to save the planet, and in fact, they could destroy the planet. So,
well, could we expect? Let's look at a supposition. What if the well, global warming, whether that's real or not, that's another issue. But let's just say something happens with the sun and temperatures are rising here. We're about to could we expect an ET intervention, or would they just move us off world and go to the next planet?